Welcome to Season 2 of The Great Humbling. My name's Dugald Hine. I'm a writer and co-founder of a school called Home. Through the strange spring of 2020, I kept a weekly appointment with the futurist Ed Gillespie, where we would puzzle our way through the stories taking shape around the pandemic and how all this fits into a longer arc of social, political, and ecological crisis. We called these conversations The Great Humbling because we started from a sense that this is a time of being humbled, brought down to earth. And we wanted to ask what happens if we approach the moment we're in on those terms. Now we're back for a second season, where each week we'll be taking a state of mind that seems to be part of the mix of being alive just now. So this is The Great Humbling Season 2, Altered States. States of being, states of consciousness, and of course, the literal alteration of our nation states. Thanks for listening. Okay, this is the next to the last episode of Season 2, and we're recording it on a Tuesday morning with 7 days to go until the US presidential election. So we can't put it off any longer, this thing I've been threatening us with for weeks, which is that we do an episode where we talk about American politics and how it fits into this larger conversation about what it means if we're living in a time of, well, great humbling. Trying to do this in a suitably humbled way, because I talk to friends in the US who are genuinely fearful of what's coming next. We've had an autumn of articles about whether there's a civil war around the corner, and you know, whether or not they're right, my body isn't on the line. My body doesn't put me straight in the line of fire when the equivalents of Trump get in power in countries like the ones where we live, either. So it just feels necessary to name that before we go any further. But the question is, what state are we in this week? What state feels appropriate to this conversation about the disunited states of America? Where we landed is a state of jeopardy. I cannot spell this word for the life of me. It's like literally the hardest word to spell in the English language, as far as I'm concerned. Ed, you're good with this stuff. Where does it come from?
Well, I'm going to correct any kind of false belief that it's got anything to do with leopards, which is basically lion panther, leopard. But actually, jeopardy itself goes back to the 14th century, and it's actually originally used in the context of chess and other games to denote a problem or a position in which the chances of winning or losing are evenly balanced. And it's actually also known as the chess problem. And the root is somewhere in medieval Latin, where it's about jocus partitus, an even chance, which comes from, you know, the combination of jest and play and game with divide. But it can also mean an exposure to imminence of death or loss or injury, or the danger that an accused person is subjected to when on trial for a criminal offence. So it's got that combination of things. But I think that the sense of a divided game is probably most apposite.
There's always something that comes to the surface when we start breaking open the words like this. You know, what struck me is that Latin jocus. So it's actually the same root that we get joke from. This idea that there is a kind of joke-like quality to the deep structure of reality is something that I come back to. If I have learnt one thing this series, maybe it will be how to spell the word jeopardy. But I guess part of why jeopardy felt like the right state for this week is this sense of a divided game, a balanced game, or things hanging in the balance. I mean, it's not like the opinion polls are suggesting it's an even match, but many of us find it harder to trust the opinion polls than we did a few years ago. I think it's probably pretty obvious which outcome you and I would wish for next week. And yet there's also a sense that this is a fork in the road with two different paths, but there is no path from here that doesn't lead to a bumpy landing of one kind or another. And I remember 4 years ago, the Brexit referendum, the American election, both times I sat down to switch on the news coverage and watch the results. And I thought Remain was going to win. I thought Clinton was going to win. I don't have any great knack of political prediction, let's say. How about you, Ed? Did you see those things coming in 2016?
No, I mean, I'm also moved to think about your reference to joke, actually, because, you know, there's people who say we're actually living in a simulation. 2016 and the seismic shifts then were someone gaming the levers just to see what would happen if the kind of unthinkable began to happen. I remember waking up after the Trump election and saying to my partner at the time, I said, they elected the monster. And her reply just going, I knew they would. And she's half American, so she had one foot in that camp. I mean, even more vivid memory, actually, of waking up in Stockholm to the result of the Brexit vote, because I'd taken the sleeper train out there, arrived the day before, and had a sort of rather lonely, melancholy evening by myself in Stockholm, and gone to bed early, and woke up about five, and went to check my phone for the result, and then check myself and thought, no, what's the point of doing that? And actually, with a weird discipline, I didn't look, and then went back to sleep for 2 hours, and then finally switched my phone on at seven and saw the result and thought, oh God. And it was very weird because I was then going to speak and attend Almedalen, you know, the great sort of Swedish power broking decision makers and opinion formers bun fight.
This is such a strange thing that we have to explain it to those who are not initiated to Swedish politics. Basically, imagine if all of the party conferences took place at the same time, in the same place, like all the politicians and political leaders and lobbyists and everybody else goes to an island for a week, and each day a different party has their day at the center of attention. It's mad.
Oh, and it's brilliant. But as you say, also very, very wonderfully Swedish. And I just had days, as you can imagine, trying to explain to incredulous Swedes what had happened, you know, and I was literally just walking around going, well, I have no idea either.
You know, the bit that I find hardest to relate to in all of that is this thing where you wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning and then you don't check the result and you go back to sleep. And I am a horrible election junkie. Like, this goes back to, I remember 1987. I didn't stay up all night in 1987. I was like 9 years old. But I remember taking a transistor radio into the school playground to listen to the Today program and the World at One and so on, so that I could just follow this election campaign day by day through the whole build up to Thatcher getting re-elected with a landslide. So that was a cheery introduction to democracy for me. So I stayed up all night on Brexit referendum night and on American election night in 2016. And that means that twice I had this experience where the initial result was looking like Remain had won, and then again a few months later looking like Clinton had won. And each time I remember when that came out, feeling this strange pang of sadness. And it definitely wasn't because I wanted the other result, but it was because I knew that nothing would be learned. I knew that all of the uncomfortable stuff that had come to the surface during these campaigns would get swept under the carpet again.
I think that's a repeated trope for our generation, isn't it? It's going into it with some degree of hopeful optimism and then that dread sliding away through the small hours of the morning when you realise it's actually not going to pan out. I mean, in some ways, I had to wait till I was 25, you know, to still be up for Portillo in 97, to actually have an election that I felt vaguely hopeful about. And actually came back from Australia specifically to vote for that one. And I remember going back to Norwich, my hometown, and hooking up with a couple of old mates and, yes, staying up for Portillo. I think the next generation after that was then Obama in 2008. I remember watching that with my Futera colleagues and really believing perhaps it was a game changer in some respects, because it felt so unlikely knowing the historical context. It felt like, you know, the simulation had lurched in a rather good direction for a change.
I have this weird history with writing about the aftermath of elections. It started with 2015, when David Cameron was unexpectedly re-elected with a majority, and lots of people were quite sort of traumatized by that unforeseen outcome. It seems quite tame now in hindsight. And I wrote this post called "The Only Way Is Down." It's the only thing I've written in my life that has gone totally instantly viral. It was read by about 70,000 people over the next 2 days. And briefly, it felt like large parts of the British liberal left were kind of on the couch and I was offering them some sort of therapy. And then everyone got slightly embarrassed by how emotional and raw they'd been in the immediate aftermath. And various people who had contacted me about projects they wanted to do stopped replying to my mails, and it all sort of disappeared again quite quickly, which was interesting. After the Brexit vote, I was sort of too angry with everybody, actually as much with my own side as anybody else, to write anything. But then after Trump was elected, I did this piece called "When the Maps Run Out." And one thing that came back when I sent that out to my email newsletter was somebody who said, "Hang on a minute, you're bracketing together voting for Brexit and voting for Trump. I read the stuff you write. I voted for Brexit. I would never have voted for Trump, and I feel upset being grouped together." And she said, "I voted for Brexit because in my entire life, I had never heard the politicians say anything positive about the EU until the referendum campaign. So why should I believe them?" I'm not saying that's a good argument, but it's quite a humanly understandable example of somebody trying to make sense of the choice that is put before them and the experience of politics that they've had. So, you know, I got told off for treating the Brexit vote and the Trump vote as interchangeable, and fair enough. But still, I think it is worth analysing their interconnections. And the best book I've read about that was Anthony Barnett's book, "The Lure of Greatness." And part of what he captures in that is the impulse to break out of the prison of neoliberal realism that is contained within both the Brexit vote and the Trump vote. And he also captures the overdetermined nature, the multiple causes layered on top of each other behind these dramatic events of 2016. And so I was quite excited when I saw that Anthony had written a piece together with Adam Ramsey, who I also rate a lot at Open Democracy, about this forthcoming American election. It's a piece called "Behind Trump's Lies is a Hard Truth About the US, and Under Biden's Truths is a Lie." It's a good title. It was a bit of a disappointing piece for me, though, because they start by arguing that the whole story about Trump's election having anything to do with white working class voters is a fantasy. Here's what they say. "Many keyboards have been strummed to compose a great fiction about Trumpism. His support is angry working class America. He rides on the shoulders of imagined, ill-educated, overweight buffoons with guns on their hips and spittle on their lips. His rallies echo with the howls of underdogs. This imagery appeals to liberal snobbery and conservative mythology, but it is a lie. Trump's voters in 2016 were, on average, richer than Hillary Clinton's, and much whiter, slightly maler, and significantly older. These aren't the marginalized, they are a coalition of the marginalizers." And Ta-Nehisi Coates made a related argument, actually, a year or so after Trump's election in a piece called "The First White President." What he said is, "What defines Trump's voters isn't that they're downtrodden, but they're white. That's the demographic fact that most describes the coalition of people who voted for Donald Trump in 2016. Now, I'm hesitating here because these are smart people who I have a lot of respect for, and I don't have any particular credentials as a political analyst, so I'm expecting someone to tap me on the shoulder and gently explain to me what I'm getting wrong. But from where I'm standing, it looks like there's something missing from this analysis. So clearly, yes, it's true that if you look at Trump's winning coalition in 2016, its defining characteristic was its whiteness. And it's also true that if you take an average of Republican voters in 2016, you'll find they had a higher income than Democrat voters. But there are two things here. Firstly, a simple average doesn't tell us everything we need to know about that coalition. And secondly, to understand what Trump's election meant, you can't just look at his coalition in 2016. You have to compare it to the coalition of Republican voters in previous elections. Now, Ta-Nehisi Coates does acknowledge this, albeit in passing, in his piece. He says, Trump's share of the white vote was similar to Mitt Romney's in 2012. According to the CNN exit polls, which is the best data we've got to go on, Romney led Obama by 20 points in the share of the white vote. And 4 years later, Trump led Clinton among the same group by 20 points. So the whiteness of the Republican electoral coalition isn't a Trump phenomenon. It's a phenomenon of the racialization of American politics and the whole history of race and racism in the US, which Coates writes about eloquently in that piece and elsewhere.
Yeah, you can often see that if you transpose the maps, can't you, of voting tendencies and previously slave or slave-supporting states. There's some uncanny kind of alignments when you start to overlay the different maps together.
Well, you've got these patterns and, you know, actually this history of the coalitions sort of swapping at different points between the Republicans and the Democrats through US electoral history. Here's the bit, though, that I wanted to home in on, which is, you know, what does look more like a Trump phenomenon is what happened in terms of the economic background of voters. Because if the racial background of voters for the Republicans didn't change between 2012 and 2016, the economic background does seem to have changed. In 2012, Obama led by 22% among voters with an income lower than $50,000 a year, while Romney led by 10% among voters with an income above $100,000 a year. In 2016, that changed significantly. Clinton still led amongst low-income voters, but only by 12%, so 10% less. And among high-income voters, she was level with Trump. So you'd gone from a 10% difference between the Republicans and the Democrats to the Republicans and the Democrats being on level pegging, apparently, according to the exit polls. There is more going on here than the data will show us, because part of the drop-off in low-income voters for the Democrats between those two elections is going to be poor black voters who came out for Obama but stayed home 4 years later. And there are probably shy Trump voters amongst the high-income group. But still, the basic implication here is that Trump lost high-income, highly educated voters from the existing Republican coalition to Clinton, but gained lower income, lower educated voters in just enough of the right places to make up for it. And that his appeal to that group of voters seems to have been his personal contribution to winning the election. Maybe it's just that we're talking about two different things here between what I'm trying to say and those pieces by Ramsey and Barnett and Coates, because if we're talking about moral culpability, then sure, it's shared amongst everyone who voted for Trump, and the focus on non-college educated, lower income white voters obfuscates that. But if we're talking about understanding Trump's distinctive appeal, then to just take an average of the income of Republican voters and use that to call all talk of the role of class a lie, well, it seems like an incomplete analysis.
We all rush for that simple analysis, don't we? You know, whether it's Clinton's reference to the basket of deplorables, you know, or you hear it in the UK and the sort of white van man and Little Englanders, the Brexiteers and the Ramoners. Perhaps that notion of the contempt for different people is an interesting theory, where we've got people being disparaged by an elite, which is certainly the draining of the swamp aspect that Trump seems to try and zero in on, and certainly plays a key role at the rally. You know, it's like, well, you brought in a swamp engineer who's actually a swamp architect. It's like, not so much draining the swamp as filling it. Again, I think a lot of these theories often don't hold true the more you sort of dig underneath the surface. They're drawn from some assumptions which are often tenuous at best.
I mean, I remember what angered me the morning after the Brexit referendum. And it was when half the people in my Facebook feed were sharing this graph that showed, apparently, again, based on the exit polls, that the higher your level of education, the more likely you were to have voted Remain. And I was like, well, what's the implication of this? Are you saying that we should really weight people's votes according to the number of years they've spent in education? Like, I remember working in Sheffield as a journalist and seeing this set of data that came out that showed the proportion of young people going to university by parliamentary constituency for the UK. And back then it was sort of Nick Clegg down in southwest Sheffield in the leafy suburbs. And off the top of my head, it's like 68% of 19-year-olds with a home address in his constituency were in higher education. And up at the top right of Sheffield, in what was then David Blunkett's constituency, where my sister lives now, it was about 12% of 19-year-olds in higher education. Maybe there are people out there who will go, well, that just reflects meritocracy and that the children of the upper middle classes are more intelligent than the children of the working classes and the poor. I doubt if many of my friends would actually be prepared to stand behind that. So, you know, part of what we know is that your education is a mark of privilege. Like, the strongest predictor of whether you're likely to go to university is your parents' income and whether they went to university. So the ease with which, by implication or directly, we dump on those who don't have the same credentials, that leaves me very uneasy, let's say.
Yeah, well, it's just a saying, because you don't agree with me, you must be stupid. I mean, at its kind of simplest essence, it's like going, you've made a bad decision because you're not smart enough to have realized the full implications.
Well, I'm mixing it up with, you know, because you're poorer than me, because you've had less privilege than me, you're thicker than me. And it's like, you know, I've really felt more alienated from a lot of the people I had kind of worked with and spent time around in my adult life than the morning after the Brexit vote. Actually, I remember thinking about the folk clubs that I grew up singing in the northeast of England, and, you know, just going, I know that most of the people I knew from that world will have voted Leave. And I remembered this song came from one of the ports on the East Coast. It was written by a guy whose dad had been a trawler man, and the chorus to the song goes something like this. I know with each new generation, everything must change. Of the good things we once took for granted, not much now remains. But I ask the rains that rattle all along the Great North Wall, could they not have left a little? Did they have to take it all? Oh, that song moves me to the core. And I'm not willing to concede the politics of loss to the elements within politics that I most despise. I guess that was sort of my alienation at that moment in June 2016, when people were going, can't you write us something that will help us make sense of and find meaning and console ourselves in the aftermath of this terrible referendum result? I was like, actually, I just want to tell you all to fuck off.
And it's a good job that, you know, the subsequent years have been full of conciliation rather than entrenchment.
Oh, yeah. That's gone well, hasn't it? I guess part of why I wanted to talk about this was this week I went back and reread something from that spring of 2016 by this blogger who goes under the name of Anne Amnesia. It was a piece that went so viral that I think she basically disappeared from blogging after that because she was freaked out by the amount of attention. But she was someone I'd been in touch with occasionally over the years. In fact, I'd interviewed her earlier that year for a Dark Mountain book, and we talked about the collapsosphere, this strange mix of blogs, mostly from North America, that I'd been reading since the mid-noughties, one of the things I remember from 2016 is that those collapse bloggers often seemed like the only people who had a handle on and a subtler analysis of this whole set of shocks that were completely blindsiding the official narrators of political reality, the people who stand in front of the cameras and tell us how things work and what's likely to happen and so on. But Anne's post really stood out because she was writing in a small town in the American Rust Belt, and she'd actually spent several months sitting in with the medical examiner. So basically seeing the bodies that end up on the slab for autopsy in that town each day. Most of the bodies that are coming for autopsy were coming from opiate overdoses and suicides. And she's writing about that in her piece. The piece is called The Unnecessariat. She says it's this tide that is on a par with, and actually statistically has since surpassed, the scale of death from the AIDS epidemic in the 80s and early 90s, which she had personal memory of. But she said there's a difference because there's no response, there's no mobilization, there's no activism around this current tide of dying in these places like the town where she lives. The only people paying attention are the statisticians and the public health workers. This is what she writes. There's no sense of oppressive doom over everyone. There's no overdose death art. There are no musicals. There's no community rising up in anger, demanding someone bear witness to their grief. There's no sympathy at all. The term of art in my part of the world is dirty butts. Who cares? Let the dirty butts die. And she talks about Guy Standing's coinage, the precariat, this term that he came up with to describe this sort of new class of people who don't have the sorts of protections and securities that employment in the mid to late 20th century meant for most workers in Western societies. And Anne says, you know, precariat doesn't cover it for the people she's talking about here. From where I live, the world has drifted away. We aren't precarious. We're unnecessary. The money has gone to the top. The wages have gone to the top. The recovery has gone to the top. And what's worst of all, everybody who matters seems basically pretty okay with that. And at the end of this post, she's writing a letter to a friend of hers who's a postdoc on a career path in academia. And she's writing it on the day when she goes to vote in the primaries in her state. And she says, I was really torn between voting for Sanders in the Democratic primary or helping to make sure that Trump, rather than somebody else, is the Republican candidate. And she's, she's not saying this in a kind of, in any normal sense, a pro-Trump way. This is what she says. She says, Clinton doesn't give a shit about me. When Clinton talks about people hurt by the economy, she means you. Elite educated white collar people with obvious career tracks who are having trouble with their bills and their 401k plans. Trump doesn't have an economic plan for me either. What Trump's boys have for me is a noose. But that's the choice I'm facing, a lifetime of grueling poverty or apocalypse. Yeah, I know, not fun and games, the shouts, the smashing glass, the headlights on the lawn. But what am I supposed to do? Raise my kid to stay one step ahead of the inspectors? And don't, for the love of God, don't ever miss a payment on your speeding ticket? A noose is something I know how to fight. A hole in the frame of my car is not. A lifetime of feeling that sense that, oh shit, of recognition that another year will go by without any major change in the way of things. Little misfortunes upon misfortunes. A lifetime of paying a grand a month to the same financial industry, busily padding the 401k plans of cyclists in spandex who declare a new era of prosperity in America. Who can find clarity, a sense of self, any kind of redemption in that world? Fuck it. Give me the fascists. I'll know where I stand. And I guess that to me is why I just want to break apart this story that says, no, it was all a lie. That Trump's election and these electoral ruptures had anything to do with something going wrong down near the bottom end of society. I understand why people have genuine concern about the whitewashing of racism in the way that that story sometimes gets told, but it's too simple to make it all about a coalition of the marginalizers and the oppressors.
it sort of comes down to some of the labels, doesn't it? I mean, there's a real power, actually, in what Anamnesia is describing there, from precariat to unnecessariat. And I'm sort of minded to reflect on, you know, the differences between the so-called left behind versus the held back. There's a lot of political rhetoric around the reframing of people, but, you know, people aren't being held back. You know, they're being put down and ruthlessly exploited at the level that she's describing. You can also see it in the way that people refer to the difference between the deserving and the undeserving poor, as if there's some kind of worthiness to some aspects of poverty and then a fecklessness to others. You also saw it through the pandemic when people were talking about the difference between, or the transformation of, low-skilled workers into key workers. But I think the notion that she's tapping into of this sort of the terrible suffering that goes on in-work poverty, where people are actually even working and still finding themselves in desperate conditions. And that sort of starts to feel like some kind of throwback to the ideas of indentured labour, people reliant on food banks, and the current crisis that's going on in the UK, where you've got a premiership footballer who's having to lead the campaign to ensure that kids don't go hungry in the school holidays. I mean, I'm not saying this is quite workhouse type of territory, but it certainly feels like there's echoes of these things here. And that connects back to what you were saying, that title of the Anthony Barnett and Adam Ramsey piece is, you know, behind Trump's lies is a hard truth, because these people are being marginalized. And I remember watching the film 13th, which is about the 13th Amendment, and learning that there's more black indentured labor in US prisons now than there was on plantations during the era of slavery. Now, that's absolutely mind-blowing in terms of these really hard truths that sit behind some of the obfuscation and lies that we tell ourselves.
So there's one story about 2016 and Trump and Brexit and so on that's done the rounds in plenty of different forms, but it was summed up for me by a Swedish professor, Sverker Sörlin, at an event in Stockholm a couple of years ago. I think he sort of unintentionally helped me see something that's hidden within this story. So the title of the event was, Is There Hope? And the actual context of it was around climate change. It was just after David Wallace Wells had published his initial article of The Uninhabitable Earth. Sörlin was saying, well, look, here's how it is. We've got like two worldviews operating in the world today. There's worldview A versus worldview B. Those who believe in science, reason, technology, and progress on the one side, and those who see a future undermined by fear and threat. And the first group, subscribers to what he calls worldview A, are the ones who are engaging with the issues of the Anthropocene and climate change and so on, while the others, the worldview Bers, well, he says, shaking his head, these are the ones who don't even believe that climate change is happening. And you know, you recognize this. You've heard one version of this or another over the last 4 years, where you've basically got the good guys and the bad guys, and everything hangs on whether the good guys are going to prevail. But as I'm sitting there listening to his way of describing that, I suddenly hear this thing ringing in the back of my head. This idea from an essay by the poet T.S. Eliot about 17th century poetry. It's an essay that he wrote in the early 1920s. He coined this phrase, dissociation of sensibility. So the dissociation, like the separation of sensibility. And he said something happened in the mind of England around the time of the English Civil War that was a kind of split between heart and head. And he was looking at it originally just within poetry and saying, you know, after that point, you can find the same poet thinking or feeling, but you never find them doing it in the same passage of poetry in the way that was possible in earlier generations. And as a piece of literary criticism, that's highly debatable. But what struck me was that in Sörlin's map of worldview A and worldview B, where worldview A is to do with science, reason, technology, and progress, and worldview B is like fear and threat, that isn't a choice between two ideologies. That's a map of a dissociated society. got one group of people who are heavily invested in rationality. And, you know, there's something weird about what he says. He says, oh, they're the people who believe in science, reason, and technology. So they're not just scientists, perhaps not scientists at all. They are the believers. And there's something kind of weird about mixing belief and rationality like that. And equally, I want to say, hang on a minute, when fear is placed in the second category, because it seems to me that fear is an appropriate response when you read an article by David Wallace Wells about climate change. And so the picture I suddenly got as I was sitting there in this event was, right, at some level, we've ended up split between, you know, one group of people who can think the mess we're in, but not feel it. You know, they're hooked on belief in optimism and progress and so on, and technological solutions. And another group of people who are so alienated from science and experts and the way that science and expertise is wielded as an object of belief, that they don't accept the facts about the mess we're in. And yet their gut level sense of the depth of the mess we're in is in some sense truer to where we find ourselves than the kind of progressive Hans Rosling TED talk narrative of progress that the first group are pretty much identified with. And I thought back to that this week because another of these collapse bloggers, Ram Prieur, had a post where he just talked in passing about what healing means at a cultural level. And he said, healing a culture requires individuals to have better head-body integration. And I can't help feeling that somewhere within the tangle of what we're talking about when we talk about the events of 2016 and the rest of it, that speaks to something true and something that often goes missing from the more straightforward political analyses of what's going on.
That totally gives me the shivers, that idea of better head-body integration as cultural healing. I mean, I shared a Facebook memory this week of the two-year anniversary of the Mundus Imaginalis course with Martin Shaw that I attended at Schumacher. I described it 2 years ago as a turning point in my life. And definitely feels like that in hindsight. And for me, that was really the kind of one of the key parts of my personal journey, which probably began in 2014 at the New Story Summit in Findhorn, where many of the characters that we often reference through our conversations were in attendance. I think for me, it was when I started to overcome my own dissociation of sensibility. It was listening to firsthand witness testimony of some of the ravages of neoliberalism and you know, the damage to the planet, the damage to communities, and hearing it from these very grueling testaments from people. I actually think I felt all of that stuff physically for the first time. I remember being physically racked with sobs. I'd been an environmentalist for 20 years and I'd been working on all of this stuff, but I think I'd internalized it in my head. You know, I was thinking it, but I wasn't feeling it. It was really then that integration of head, heart, gut started to come together for me in the way that Martin Shaw often talks about skin, flesh and bone memory. It went deep, you know, it went right into the soul of my being. And I think it's then that I started to want to be part of all those barbarians, again, as Martin would frame it, with that sort of activist romanticism that acknowledges this full spectrum of human emotion. Like you're saying, you know, there's a deep gut felt truth to some of the frustrations which have manifested themselves in Trump and Brexit. And I think that connects to that piece you shared the other week by John Michael Greer about hate is the new sex. It's like we have to embrace that full spectrum of human emotion to reassociate our sensibilities, because it's only by finding out ways of timelessly teasing them into something more tender rather than terrible that we have a chance of perhaps challenging some of the jeopardy in which we find ourselves.
I'm listening to you talk about that and I'm thinking about one of the people I've met since 2016 who again comes up in these conversations a lot and has helped me to sort of find roots through all of this. Vanessa Andreotti. And the first time I heard her speak, she was talking about, you know, the head intelligence, the heart intelligence, and the gut intelligence. Mm. And that within the, you know, the culture that she comes from, with her indigenous roots in Brazil, that you don't start with the head intelligence and you have to get these things working together. It's interesting because Vanessa and the Decolonial Futures group that she works with would put a bit of a warning sign against this language of romanticism. They'd say, you know, when we hit how deep a mess we're in, like one of the reactions they observe going on is a rationalist response of trying to come up with plans and solutions and social innovations. And there's another one, which is a romantic response, which often ends up elevating other people's cultures and other times in history and so on. And they say that the response to which they feel most closely aligned is this non-Western psychoanalytic response of sort of processing, composting our own shit. I remember walking around Paris with Vanessa in December 2018. It was Vanessa and Bio Akumalafe, and we were hanging out around the edges of this strange plurality university gathering. And Vanessa had just been back to Brazil for the first time since Bolsonaro was elected. Vanessa said something that really struck me. She said, you know, a lot depends on whether people feel that the promises that were made to them were broken or whether they see that these were false promises all along. So in a Brazilian context, she was like, so many people have been given this promise, this kind of TED Talk promise of how they're going to become part of the new expanding global middle class and they're on this trajectory of progress. And, you know, and lots of that has failed and also left them with a deep sense of loss of the destruction of communities and solidarity and the networks of support that a generation earlier had helped people through hard times that have been eroded in this transformation that's been going on. So the promises of modernity are failing. The question is, do people think, well, we could have had that future we were promised if it wasn't for the corrupt politicians, which is the card that Bolsonaro played? Or do they see that there was something wrong with those promises all along, that they couldn't have been fulfilled, that it wouldn't even have been a good thing for them to be fulfilled at lots of levels?
It resonates with me again in terms of the personal recognition of that sense of false promise. I found myself as a consultant in that Alice in Wonderland believing six impossible things before breakfast, just because the turmoil of pragmatism, where you sort of, you're trying to understand whether you're actually making a difference or whether you're actually changing anything. And it, I found myself sort of connecting into sort of the Apocalypse Now Vietnam thing, where you're going, well, we had to destroy the village in order to save it. It feels like a kind of madness. And it was my own sort of epiphany around the essential failure of sustainability. I'm going to write a poem about it, which I just think for me, it was, this was the way of expressing in 10 lines, you know, what I was feeling, which was, it's just called Beyond Sustainability. Like a crazy horse that's bolted, running a race that's long since halted, or a kite grounded through lack of breeze, a clifftop drive with Thelma and Louise. It's a journey, not a destination. A long way back, we passed the last station. A runaway train that's been derailed, retaking exams you repeatedly failed. Sustaining what? Is the question that burns beyond the tortured twists and turns. After anger, pain and blame, I see a different future's flame. Past grief and loss, I catch its flicker. Sustaining this just kills it quicker.
I like it.
And I think perhaps that's where the real block is. You know, we obscure the greater possibility through the infighting over the immediately impossible.
I'm remembering something from Bio Akumalafe, who was with us in Paris that weekend in 2018, from an essay that he wrote in the wake of Charlottesville, like the horrific far-right protest gathering and the murder of a anti-fascist protester by somebody who drove a car into a group of protesters. And Bio's writing, as a black man not living in America, but like all of us, having the imagination colonized by America, you know, the way America slips into our dreams and teaches us how to desire. And In this essay, which is called Homo Icarus, The Depreciating Value of Whiteness and the Place of Healing, there's a passage that I keep coming back to. He says, "It's a radical thing to say, and a most dangerous notion to admit, that in some non-mystical way I am practically entangled with those people I would rather demonize as white supremacists and Nazi sympathizers. The dual framework permits us to separate the racist from the non-racist, to install a fundamental distinction between their absolute depravity and our detached moral coherence, and to defer and deflect responsibility. There are not too many places to go from there. When we begin from this set of assumptions, incarceration, conversion therapy, and reverse oppression are the responses that almost always follow. However, in a non-dual framework, such as the one described by indigenous notions of crossroads, it emphasizes entanglements, intersectionality, diffraction, and intraaction. You won't get satisfying calls to action from the kind of voice that you're hearing there from Bio. And for some people, that will feel like an abdication of responsibility politically. Mm. And yet I have to sit with and stay with and be shaped by these voices that say, as Bio often says, the situation is urgent. We need to slow down.
Mm. Now, as you say, it's beyond that call to action. It's how do you build those humble bridges? I was struck by something Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said, trying to address directly to the young men of the white far right and the alt-right. And she said, you know, there's a mother waiting for you. I know it. I know there's a teacher waiting for you saying, what happened to my kid? What happened to my friend? And we will always be here and hold space for you to come back. We will love you back. You are not too far gone. That's not perfect in itself, but it is that outreach of an open hand rather than the throwing up of a flat palm to say stop. You know, it's actually trying to draw people in. If I was going to finish on something in regard to this idea of jeopardy, it is that softer listening that Bio is sort of touching on. It can feel like a bit of a Hobson's choice. We don't get an option for none of the above. We've got to take it or leave it. We can't reopen all nominations. We get the option then of more of the same versus fuck the system, which is what we've kind of had. I'll finish with Umair Haq. Probably a good time to bring in the Armageddon Meister, his latest piece. Our civilization is now reaching an omega point, the point of irreversible collapse. He says omega is game over. It's the point at which the costs of our existential threats exceed our civilization's economic resources. And when that point is hit, there's no turning back. Collapse is inevitable. And he says, you know, we're somewhere between 10 to 15 years away from hitting omega. And he breaks it down very clearly with a global GDP of $80 trillion. 10% of that has already gone in dealing with COVID. We're dealing with 15% of it on climate. And there's 25% of that which will be taken up by mitigating the impacts of ecological collapse. The lesson he draws from the pandemic, which is a humbling one, and coming out of a hard lockdown, is that this has to be a reset, not a pause, because the alternative is to jeopardize everything.
When people start talking about the fate of our civilization, I always want to say, hang on a minute, this grand story of civilization, you know, which we are we talking about here? Too much gets left out of that story. If I want to frame for what's worth doing, it's more like the subtitle of Anand Singh's wonderful book, The Mushroom at the End of the World. We're looking for the possibilities of life within capitalist ruins. I guess that's my point about Trump, that in amongst all the absolute horseshit and the racism and the misogyny and the rest of it, he's gestured towards the extent to which we are already living among ruins. And if you want my prediction, then a week from now, America will elect Joe Biden, not by a landslide, but not by a hair's breadth either. And Donald Trump will bluster a bit, but he won't really try to overturn the result. And he certainly won't start a civil war, because it's going to turn out that he never had the discipline to be a proper fascist or whatever. He was just the world's biggest troll. And as you may remember from the start of this program, I have an excellent track record of predicting the results of elections. Not. Well, we'll be here again next week. Until then, take care, stay safe, and as Nathan Barley would say, keep it humble.
Thank you for listening to The Great Humbling. We see this podcast as very much an exploration, not a prescription. A provisional investigation that maybe loves questions more than answers to begin with and needs a little time and space to breathe. If you are new to the podcast, please do revisit season one, as we are aiming to build on ideas, insights and narratives already touched upon. And together, this will hopefully enable us all to make a little more sense of these strange times we are living through. Please do comment, ask questions and respond via our Facebook page, The Great Humbling, or via my Twitter account, @Frucall. And we would obviously deeply appreciate and be grateful for any ratings, reviews, recommendations or sharing you might feel compelled to contribute as a result of listening. Our title music is I Recall by Blue Dot Sessions, used gratefully under a Creative Commons license. We're living in a time of humbling, an initiation at a cultural scale. Please join us on this emergent journey.